Welcome to Planetary Conversations. I'm your host, Warren Bell. Each week I talk with experienced and knowledgeable guests from all backgrounds and walks of life as we explore ideas and actions that can restore the health of our planet and heal our relations with one another. Check out our website at voiceoftheshoeshop.ca, and you can find all our episodes on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. But first, we openly and freely acknowledge that we live and work in Shukapmakulu, the stolen, ancestral, and unceded lands of the Suquepic people. We in the settler community have a critical responsibility to do our very best to resolve this historical injustice in a way that is satisfactory to our Indigenous friends and neighbors. Biography is a popular and widely produced form of the written word. We read about actual persons or a particular family or an aggregation of humans and inevitably compare ourselves to the subjects of the narrative. Reading a biography of the entire human race, however, is a different matter, particularly if the biography extends a long way back in time and covers a vast array of the societies and cultures that we humans have established on planet Earth. To write such a biography requires a team, a multidisciplinary team, who can bring a range of expertise to bear on such a far-reaching subject. There is a single author's name on the cover because one mind helps maintain coherence and continuity. But authors these days often openly and gratefully acknowledge the input of others, knowing it reduces the likelihood of errors of fact or interpretation. Group work is a growing phenomenon in our age. That's sensible when we face problems that have complex and global implications, both in time and in space and in meaning. Our future and that of our planetary home are now very clearly at stake. What we choose to do today will have profound impacts on future generations. So getting it right is more than just an aspirational goal. It can mean the difference between profound benefit and profound harm. Today's guest is the author of the biography, such as I've just described. Luke Kemp is a senior research associate at the Center for the Study of Existential Risk at Cambridge University. The book is Goliath's Curse, and the subtitle is The History and Future of Societal Collapse. It's a biography of our species, a monumental biography of Homo sapiens since we first appeared around 300,000 years ago. It lays out our impact on one another and the planet in exquisite detail using a wealth of scientific and other evidence. Goliath's Curse is a kaleidoscopic exploration of where we've been and what we've done, and it leads to evidence-informed and compelling conclusions about what we, all of us together, can do in the next phase of our collective evolution. So, Luke, we're delighted to have you join us today. From where are you actually today?
I'm in Cambridge, UK, and Warren, I'm delighted to be speaking to you today.
Well, it's when we're talking about game-changing and paradigm-shifting, I think we can never have too many conversations of this sort. By the way, what's happened to your life since the book came out, this fairly significant and monumental book? How's your life changed?
I've had to do a lot more podcasts and media than I would usually. And apart from that, a bit more travel to, of course, speak to readers, etc. But apart from that, it hasn't changed a great deal. My bread and butter is still reading and writing, trying to understand the world. And I'm now working on a second book on the history and future of mass surveillance. So some things remain unchanged. But one other thing that has changed is I'm increasingly trying to think about how to put the recommendations and ideas of the book into practice.
Specifically regarding that, what kind of response are you hearing from various sectors in society, obviously the academic world, but also the public at large, maybe even decision makers? Are they becoming aware of this movement that your book is part of?
Yes, I believe so. There's been a groundswell of support for ideas like open democracy, the use of citizen assemblies and citizens' juries. And I've certainly seen more of that happening. For instance, on Saturday, I was part of a march to have a pause on the development of new AI models in London. And that was culminating in a citizens' assembly on AI. So these ideas are definitely picking up, and my book is just one amongst many which are calling for similar practices. The book has done, in many ways, far better than I expected. It's a tome of 460 pages, 1,000-plus endnotes. Hence, I was somewhat skeptical of how well-read it would be. But it's been a bestseller here in the UK. It's been uptaken by a huge number of readers across the world. And I have had both several people involved in business and politics reach out who are interested in what we can do based upon my analysis.
It's interesting when you write something and you put a lot of effort in it, it's always everybody's dream that somehow someone would read it and maybe people would even change their conduct in the world. I think it's inevitable that a book like this on a subject like this has that impact because it is telling a story that's different from the doom and gloom that has sort of dogged the human race and our own interpretation of our own behavior for so long. One thing I was wondering about, the Center for the Study of Existential Risk at Cambridge, I can't even imagine this happening, say, 30 years ago, an institution like this. What's it like to be part of that particular entity in terms of fomenting some of the ideas that you have in the book?
It's been instrumental. At least until a couple of years ago, because the center's shrunk quite a bit recently, unfortunately. I had a lot of colleagues who were working on things ranging from synthetic biology, so engineered pandemics, artificial intelligence, machine learning, and all rounds of different other kinds of threats, including nuclear war. And many of the chapters in the book where I deal with these kinds of topics, I had my colleagues check over them. Mm. And that put me in a really useful and helpful position where I could actually draw upon that web of experts to make sure the book was as robust as possible. Not to mention, you just have such a different array of people who are thinking about some of the biggest questions that we face that naturally it helps you think through some of the biggest questions that I had to deal with in the book as well.
I think it's widely accepted now that we're living in an era of massive social change that's so compelling that it really is different from any social change that we've been experiencing probably in the history of our species. Now, I want to go into the book, and I'd like to start with I'm going to call it a takedown of Thomas Hobbes. I don't know if that's entirely gracious with respect to a gent who lived to 91 and was very well respected in his day. The initial statement, which was written by him, he was born in 1588, after his mother went into premature labor as a result of the Spanish Armada sailing up the English Channel. And he wrote, he said, "My mother gave birth to twins, myself and fear." And reading his life was beset with chaos and confusion and instability and uncertainty and violence. There was the English Civil War. He was exiled in France himself. It's almost impossible for him, it seems to me, to have not had a very negative view of human conduct and human nature. But Goliath's Curse is truly a paradigm-shifting book. It's sort of a rewrite of human history, challenging the Hobbesian view of human nature with his book Leviathan. I wonder if you could just say the learning that took place as you were writing this book about how our Paleolithic ancestors conducted themselves, because it wasn't like we have seen them to be. And I saw words like collaborative, exploratory, peaceable, and resistant to domination. Do you want to just meditate on that a little bit about what our ancestors before the Holocene were really all about?
Of course. It's worthwhile, first of all, quickly summarizing the view of Thomas Hobbes, which pervades so much of what we read about collapse. Hobbes, the 16th century philosopher, he characterized the life of man prior to the development of states, rulers, big structures of authority as being nasty, brutish, and short, and solitary on top of that as well.
Yes.
And Hobbes's idea was that essentially we are constantly at each other's throats, and because of that, we need to give up some freedom to an overarching ruler, a supreme sovereign, in this case, the state, or Leviathan, as he would call it.
Yes. He also said that man is by nature more individualistic than social, And that's the exact contrary to what you actually found out from empirical evidence.
Precisely. So when we actually look at the period when humans developed during the Ice Age, what's called the Middle and Upper Paleolithic, from roughly 300,000 years ago through to roughly 11,000 years ago, and this is a period when we didn't have states, we didn't have big structures of authority, and as far as we can tell, we had no lasting hierarchies or even inequalities. This was a period when we didn't live in ragtag groups of families that many people imagine. When you actually look at the evidence here, the band's hunter-gatherers would be often 20 to 40 people, but they range up to 200. And importantly, an individual would know thousands of people across their lives because they're constantly moving across groups. And this created these great webs of interconnections through trade, intermarriages. And this could mean that you'd have, for instance, all the way from the east coast to the west coast of Africa, 120,000 years ago, shared tools, lithic instruments, so stone tools,
yes,
musical instruments, genes, and culture.
Yes.
This wouldn't be possible if people were constantly killing each other.
Yes.
And when I looked into it, the best available evidence, both genetically and archaeologically, is just that we probably have a lethal violence rate during that period of roughly 1 to 2%. So out of every 100 people, one or two would have died at the hands of another human, which is about as peaceful or violent as the modern world. So this was by no means a Hobbesian scramble for resources. And it's worthwhile noting that Hobbes, as well as others like Rousseau, they get the most basic fact here wrong, this idea that we're solitary.
Yes.
The reason we survive the Ice Ages while every other hominid species dies out is because we have remarkable genetic diversity, because we're particularly social and we love moving across groups and sharing.
You called our superpower storytelling and social learning, and that fits in directly with what you're talking about now.
Exactly. So this is the other big factor here, is we have this capacity for what's called cumulative cultural evolution. So not just develop culture, but to pass it across generations, yes, through things like stories. And that is something which allows us to do remarkable things with, say, for instance, technology, but also ideology. But interestingly, this is not the single thing that separates us from the rest of the hominids. As far as we can tell, Neanderthals also had the ability to pass on ideas across generations and to cumulatively evolve culture. The difference as to why they died out and we survived appears to be, once again, the fact that we were better at essentially moving across groups and, in general, having more genetic diversity.
And you also speculate that climate change interfering with their social structures to a greater degree than perhaps ours could have played a role. I'm putting in a plug for the Neanderthals, because there's a negative opinion of, if you want to degrade somebody, you say you're acting like a Neanderthal. And yet they do come across, and you make mention of this in the book, they weren't stupider. They weren't less sort of evolved in sort of their cognition, but they had different sort of lifestyles, and that may have been what got them into difficulty.
Exactly. So they were about, as far as we can tell, intelligent as us. They even did things like bury the dead with decorations, including feathers and whatnot, which suggests they had some notion of the afterlife. They had ability to create fictions and to think beyond material reality. The big difference here was that, yes, they did probably face some additional hazards here, like climate change, but they also just had far more fragmented, isolated communities. So there was one find of a Neanderthal family, and their genetic diversity was similar to what you find with endangered mountain gorillas. The problem was they didn't tend to move much across groups. The groups weren't very interconnected. And that meant if you had a change in the ratios between births and deaths, if you had one bad event, that meant one regional population could go extinct. And slowly over time, that resulted in species extinction.
Indeed.
The big difference here wasn't intelligence. It was, weirdly, our capacity for sharing and our ability to move around.
I think we've successfully rehabilitated the reputation of Neanderthals, and I'm glad it's happening. And, and I hope everybody listening to this show realizes that they can't use that term as a derogatory term anymore. Let's talk a little about size. About 50 years ago, almost exactly 50 years ago, in fact, E.F. Schumacher, the British economist, wrote a book called Small is Beautiful. And at that time, he was considered to be from a radical countercultural world, although he was talking about issues like the 20th century's intoxication with gigantism. Now, 50 years later, your book, Goliath's Curse, takes that tradition even further, and it's informed by just a whole bunch of new documentation and empirical information. Let's talk a little bit about the massive data sets that you had available to you. One was conveniently named Moros, the Greek god of doom, called the actual title is Mortality of States. And the other one is named after Shishat, the Egyptian goddess of knowledge, and it's called the Global History Data Bank. And you have 100 notes, as you mentioned, 100 pages of endnotes in this book. It's almost like that's what you have to do if you're doing a paradigm shift, and you speed up the paradigm shift by this sort of inevitable conclusion from this massive documentation. Talk about how that was important in producing this book.
Naturally, when you try to think about societal collapse, you have to think about the particular societies that collapsed. And most of the time when authors are trying to do this, they've cherry-picked a couple of examples. So Jared Diamond is perhaps the most well-known example of someone trying to deal with the idea of collapse through case studies. The problem is that he only has a couple of case studies. And out of the 5 pre-modern case studies, 3 of those are islands. One is a group of farmers in the southwest of the US, and the other is the Maya, which is basically a collection of city-states in a fairly unique environment in the tropics. It's hard to see any of these as perfect analogs for the modern world. Mm-hmm. And if you really want to understand patterns, you have to take a bigger statistical lens. And that's what drove me to look at databases and how I can use these to better understand the trends we see in collapse. And as you mentioned, I have both the Morris database, which is something I developed myself alongside Oscar Rusham and Tillman Hartley, where we basically just try to look through a whole bunch of different encyclopedias, books, etc., and get the very best estimates of when a state began, when it ended, and what were the key reasons behind its potential downfall. And apart from that, I also use the Sesha database, the world's biggest online repository of historical information, mainly maintained and curated by Dan Hoyer and Peter Turchin. And alongside all that, I just read an enormous amount of books. For 7 years, I only read nonfiction books, which was a slog at times.
After 7 years, your eyes were totally crossed on a permanent basis, practically.
Oh, yeah. I think, unfortunately, I probably have macular degeneration just from that one period.
Well, you know, the incidence of short-sightedness in China has gone from about 5% to 40% in one generation because of so many people looking at screens. So,
oh, wow.
My condolences.
Unfortunately, all that reading and those databases are what one needs in order to understand how collapse has occurred throughout the long durée of thousands of years.
I want to ask you if the concept arose in your own mind or the minds of your sort of immediate grouping, or if it was something that arose as you delved deeper and deeper into the databases, if it changed or if it was already, you had a premise and then you looked for evidence to support it, or you said, I don't have a feeling this is right, and you started to wander around through this massive amount of data, and out of it emerged this absolutely in irrefutable position that we were not like we were describing ourselves to be for a long time.
It was certainly the latter. The book does take some would even say political views. I talk about power, and power by nature is political, which has led some people to speculate that I had some pre-existing biases I simply projected into history. But I always find that quite humorous because my politics were quite different before I started writing the book compared to afterwards. Before I started writing the book, I was someone who had some empathy for Hobbes's ideas that humans weren't particularly good and we weren't particularly good at coordinating without a supreme ruler. And similarly, I would have been the kind of person who thought that maybe we just need an enlightened dictator in order to solve problems like climate change. Mm. In the course of writing the book, I completely changed on both those fundamental positions and many others as well. So to the contrary, rather than my ideology informing history, it was history informing my ideology, if you will.
That's the exact right sequence of events. I think we'll give you the Nobel Prize for learning or something. No, I mean, it's something that we all have to do. We have to. I'm a physician. And if I practiced according to an ideological perspective, I would be making mistakes all over the place. And so this kind of science-informed or data-informed approach is really sort of an essential to do anything in the 21st century that will have lasting impact. Now, I thought I'd pick a particular entity, a social entity, as an example of a Goliath. And you could maybe talk about the three characteristics of a Goliath. And the one I wanted to ask you to talk about is Cahokia, the Mississippian culture, pyramid building culture that, because sometimes we, and I myself have romanticized indigenous insights, and there are a lot of beautiful insights from indigenous cultures, the closeness to nature, the understanding of the sacred everywhere and that kind of thing. But it didn't mean that a long time ago in North America, there couldn't have been mistakes. People make up a Goliath and then it, of course, collapses. So why don't you talk about Cahokia and that civilization as an example, as the exemplar of Goliathism, if you want to call it that?
Many people assume that prior to European invasion of North America, there were only nomadic egalitarian hunter-gatherers. That is not true. Roughly two centuries before the Europeans arrived, the Americas were scattered with different kinds of indigenous hierarchical farmers, and even, as in the case of Cahokia, cities. Cahokia is nowadays an archaeological site on the outskirts of St. Louis, around about 500 kilometers southwest of modern-day Chicago. It was once a city looked fairly similar to what you'd see in a Mayan city, for instance. It was a set of flat-topped earthen pyramids surrounding one grand plaza. There were probably over 200 of these structures, and what we find inside gives us an inclination, an idea of what they were practicing. Inside many of the different mounds, we find evidence of human sacrifice. And the leading theory at this stage is that human sacrifice is being used as a way to legitimize a ruling class of priests. The city of Cahokia grew up to 10,000 to 15,000 people before eventually, roughly a century later, it began to fall apart. And within the space of about half a century, it essentially depopulated, and eventually people didn't just leave the site. They abandoned hundreds of kilometers around the Mississippi when an area that became known as the Vacant Quarter. And it didn't even leave a story about Cahokia. There's no oral tradition about the site, which is astounding when you think about this city of 10,000 people. And that area became known as the Vacant Quarter. And Cahokia, I think, is illuminating because most people, when they think about Cahokia, they think civilization. And yet, is there anything particularly civilized about what happened to Cahokia? We're talking about sometimes in one case, over 50 women, 52 of them to be precise, being executed all at the same time as a form of mass human sacrifice. Civilization is based upon this Latin root of civilitas, which has connotations of political wisdom, virtue, collaboration. That's not what we see when we look at Cahokia, nor when we look at the first dynasty of Egypt or Uruk, the very first state in Mesopotamia. Instead, what happens in all these places is you see a switch from egalitarian social arrangements to ones based upon domination, in which a small group extracts labor and energy from the others through the use of force.
Speaking of that, there's an inscription you quoted from the first Egyptian expansion into a sort of large-scale community, and it's a description after there'd been a bit of upheaval, and said, you know, this is terrible. People are being nice to each other. People are feeding each other. Everybody's sort of thinking that everybody is important rather than just some people. And it went on and on with all these complaints, which were the complaints of people who hated democracy and hated egalitarianism. I almost laughed when I read it, to be honest.
Yeah, this was the Admonitions of Ipua, which was a series of poems and texts written about what's called the First Intermediate Period, which was essentially this kind of collapse period between the Old and Middle Egyptian kingdoms.
Yes.
And The thing is, they spend less time talking about things like civil war, cannibalism, etc. It's worth noting here that we don't actually have any evidence of either mass death or cannibalism during this time.
Right.
But they spend more time talking about how suddenly the poor have access to their own sarcophagi and access to like collectively produced corn, etc. And the best bit is, this section I actually quote, it ends with, "The poor rejoiced and the nobles lamented," which I think says it all.
Yes, may we hear that sort of circumstance arising everywhere in short order around the world. So what are the characteristics that Cahokia represented or embodied that characterize what a Goliath is, the Goliath of Goliath's curse?
So a Goliath, in my telling, is a collection of dominance hierarchies, which does not just include the state. So Rome or Cahokia was not just simply the state. It was the collection of other hierarchies which underpinned the social order. So in the case of Rome, it was the distinction between men and women, slave and poor, slave and master, rich and poor. And Cahokia is based upon, like all of Goliaths, a collection of things I call Goliath fuel.
Yes.
So indeed. Interestingly, Cahokia pops up very shortly, roughly 50 years after you have the introduction of corn into the area. Now, corn, also known as maize, is quite useful insofar as you can store it for decades on end, and it really advertises itself when it's ready to be harvested. Hmm. It's a resource that is easily seen, stolen, and stored. What I call a lootable resource.
I love the term lootable.
Well, it summarizes well what's going on here, right? These are resources that can and were looted.
Yes.
When you look across the world, there's roughly 10 areas that independently invented and produced agriculture, but only 5 of those produced states. And the key difference here is that the ones who eventually got Goliaths and states were the ones that had lootable resources. Mm-hmm. There's 2 things that actually Cahokia kind of lacked, which I think would have made it a much more stable state, like we see in Egypt or in Mesopotamia. So in the case of Egypt and Mesopotamia, they don't just have wheat and barley, they also have the introduction of bronze handheld axes and swords. Mm. And once you get the introduction of those, what I call monopolizable weapons, right, you start to get hierarchies, Goliaths forming. Same in China as well, the Xia dynasty. And last but not least is the land itself can prevent people from moving. Sure. So if you take resources from people, you have the means to do so, so through monopolizable weapons, and they can't move, that's a great basis for Goliath.
The Nile Valley, for example.
Exactly. So when you look at Egypt, it's buffer between the Red Sea and the Nile. And Mesopotamia, in Greek, it literally means the land between two rivers, the Indeed. Tigris and the Euphrates.
Even though Cahokia didn't have all of those qualities, it, like all of the other Goliaths, became focused on violence. Violence became much more an element in the society. I mean, the idea of an army, two armies clashing and thousands of people being killed is something that really came on in this age of Goliath, which began with the Neolithic Revolution in about 10 to 12,000 years ago. War seems, therefore, to be almost a necessary or an inevitable outcome of the creation of a Goliath. Talk a little bit about what war impels a society to do within its own structure. There are certain characteristics that war and war fighting entities, whether it's an army or it's a bunch of technology, inculcate. What does it bring on, this progression to war?
It's worth noting that war, as far as we can tell, is a fairly modern invention.
Indeed.
We did not have war, as far as we can tell, from during the Paleolithic, so during our time as nomadic egalitarian hunter-gatherers. Across the world, in every single world region where you get empires and states, you see the same progress where people start to settle down, they start to intensify agriculture, and eventually war arrives. And then usually centuries later, maybe even thousands of years later, you get the creation of the first Goliaths. War always precedes their invention. Mm. And I believe this is because war creates a certain number of psychological responses in a population. A big one I refer to in the book is the idea of the authoritarian impulse. We have very good evidence that when people feel threatened, they shift towards authoritarian values. Mm-hmm. And this can be as basic as they start to prefer people who have more masculine features when they're facing a wartime scenario.
Masculine mean bigger, stronger, more aggressive, testosterone-driven qualities?
Exactly, yeah. Stronger jawlines, broader shoulders, bigger, more opposing, etc.
Yeah.
All the things that we usually associate with aggression and war fighting. This seems to be something that happens across people. People also tend to actually be capable of collaborating much more intensely. So our cooperation gets much better in some ways, at least within group. But we also start to become more accepting and even craving of authoritarian structures. And this is something which can help explain why you see the development of sites like Cahokia. When a threat is posed, including the creation of war and large-scale group fighting, then suddenly, for some people, it becomes worthwhile to have one person elected above others to provide some kind of peace, or at the very least, more effective war fighting. On top of that, once you get war and you get these authoritarian structures, they start to, of course, expand and create more of them. So it becomes almost like a viral contagion of sorts. And that's one of the key ways in which Goliath spread across the world.
Yeah, you do talk about large-scale organization and a kind of a unifying ideology stimulating from this sort of overarching leadership. And then, of course, the bonds that are created, the bonds that unto death, as it were, lead a mass of mostly men charging off against another mass of mostly men. And then you have a chapter, you actually devote a chapter, a whole chapter, to what you've entitled Mors Ex Machina, or Machina, nuclear war, which some people thought would be the end of war. The nuclear weapons are so horrible that you described as the worst event in human history, a nuclear war. And yet they still are sort of hanging around this sort of nostalgic attraction that they have for people in positions of power. It's kind of scary.
It truly is. And I want to touch upon what you mentioned there of it's usually groups of men charging at others at each other. You know, Hobbes would characterize this as a war of all against all, but you just don't see that either in the archaeological record or even in the modern world. It's always the war of a small group of people, usually armed young men, often those who are part of the previous state, trying to rebuild a new power structure. It's something closer to gang warfare. And even when I describe Goliath fuel, so lootable resources, monopolizable weapons, caged land, that's really about the emergence of organized crime rackets. And in many ways, history's best told as a story of organized crime rather than civilization.
That should be, maybe the next book will be called Organized Crime on a Grand Scale or something. It's not as compelling as Goliath's Curse, though. No, one of the things that enables you to categorically advance the interactions among our Paleolithic ancestors and the change that took place with the Holocene is the archaeological evidence. And there's a kind of relentless empiricism about the book. One, for example, is that traumatized skulls that have been bashed in by in ways that could not happen from a rock falling in your head or something like that, or a wild animal taking part of your leg off. Those kinds of evidence, bits of evidence for human-to-human violence are actually quite rare. I think it's sort of 1 in 1,000 skeletons or something. I can't remember the exact number in your book, but it's very rare.
Yeah, as mentioned, when you actually tally up the genetic and the archaeological evidence, it ends up being roughly 1%. But in the case of the archaeological evidence, the only genuine, undisputable sign of violence that we have from the Paleolithic is from a site called Jebel Sahaba, in which you have over 50 skeletons, which have things like crushed skulls, parry fractures, which is basically a fracture to the forearm when someone's trying to block a blow.
Right.
And Jebel Sahaba is found in modern-day Sudan. It's a site which is as well known amongst archaeologists as it is exceptional, because happened during the transition to the Holocene. So during this period of climatic and environmental upheaval, the entire area is actually cleaved in two as it developed a new valley. So this isn't exactly a great indicator of the conditions people were facing throughout most of the Paleolithic, nor of our kind of natural instincts or anything like that. Mm-hmm. So in general, we seem to be pretty non-violent. But it's also worth noting here that While we can often compare the modern world to the Paleolithic, and I did it before, I mentioned that we have very similar rates of violence at a global level. In many ways, there's something deceptive about this, because as you mentioned, we now have nuclear weapons. And in the book, I detail all the effects we could have if we had a full-blown nuclear war between the US and Russia. And in the very worst case scenario, this could kill billions of people. By one modeling study, up to 5 billion, potentially more. You didn't have that in the Paleolithic. You didn't have any weapon that could suddenly eliminate over half of humanity from the globe.
That's right.
We have that now. So it's really, in terms of violence, quite a different situation we are facing.
Indeed. And even if those 5 billion deaths would be direct deaths, there would be billions more of indirect deaths because of crop failure and disruption of other kinds of resources like water supplies and stuff. Now, one other empirical pattern in the book is the cave art that occurs in many parts of the world. There is a startling absence of any indication of intra-human society or inter-human violence. It's hunting and palm prints and different kinds of notations. But there's really a paucity of evidence of violence between humans. Moving on, one thing you said at one point, we're not chimpanzees, and it reminded me of the experiment done with Nim Chimpsky. The chimpanzee was adopted by a human family, very poorly planned, and it was a complete failure because the chimpanzee is hardwired to do all sorts of stuff that we humans don't consider to be desirable, such as being violent for no obvious reason. The Paleolithic leaders, you describe them as unpaid facilitators, which I think is a wonderful phrase. Why don't you just elaborate on what kind of leadership was prominent in, indirectly indicated by Paleolithic archaeological and paleoanthropological findings?
Yeah, so archaeologically, we can't see very good evidence of how their leaders acted per se. We can see that there were no clear hierarchies, no lasting signs of inequality.
Right.
So instead, we can look at modern-day nomadic egalitarian hunter-gatherers who are the best analogue for how these people would have lived. And what we see across the board there is that these societies are deeply democratic. Most decisions are made by the group, often on the basis of consensus. And while leaders may emerge, they tend to basically just help facilitate discussions. And importantly, they don't take any big gains from it. They don't take private property, for instance. And leadership in one area does not mean power in others. So you could be an sexually good hunter and you could lead a hunt. That doesn't mean you get more food than everyone else. And it doesn't mean that suddenly you become a god king who can have a harem or anything like that.
Yes.
So leadership tended to be very task specific, very limited, and it didn't usually involve things like violence over others. It was a prestige position, as we'd call it.
Yeah, counting coup and that kind of thing. The Holocene, I think we have to talk about the fact that the last 3% of the time that Homo sapiens has been on the planet is the time when the Goliath phenomenon emerged 10 to 12,000 years ago. It wasn't as neatly sort of demarcated as some people have thought. There's a number of books now writing about how it was kind of a fuzzy transition, but it was definite and it became broader as time went by. And it involves power. And you mentioned power. And power is not just a political issue. Of course, power is something that occurs in all relationships. There's power or lack of it. And you describe four different kinds of power, and they're worth characterizing: informational power, violent power, political power, and economic power. Can you just kind of give a little Coles Notes version of each of those, the differences between each of these?
Yeah, of course. And it's worth noting this is a brief revision of Michael Mann's Source of Social Power, which was a classic in sociology back in the 1980s. Political power is control of decision-making and authority. So if you can basically control a conversation or order others to do things in a chain of command, that would be political power. Violent power is simple. It's the ability to control the lethal means of force. So if you can threaten people or coerce them into doing your bidding, then that's violent power right there.
And it's interesting, that was the only kind of power that Hobbes said really matters. The only thing that motivates people is the fear of violent death.
Yeah, which I think he's definitely wrong there, because it's quite clear that these other matter as well. And I'd actually say the next one I'm going to speak about is one of the most important, which is economic power, the ability to control critical resources on which others depend. And this is probably the big one that changes when you get the entry into the Holocene, is that lootable resources, there's suddenly a form of economic power that you can pass across generations and you can build up into very large surpluses. And last but not least is what some would call ideological power, but I call information power. So control over information, whether that be an administration with greater information about its citizens, where they are, what they're producing, or information in by way of stories. And it's worth noting the very first states, they tended to have, yes, administrations, bureaucracies, but they also tend to have really interesting dominance-based stories to justify subjugation. So notably, all the kings of Mesopotamia, as the god kings as we call them, as well as the pharaohs of Egypt, they were either supposed to be gods, reflections of gods, or messengers of gods. And similarly, Chani had the idea of the mandate of heaven, that the emperor was upholding a social order that was mimicking the heavens. In every single case, there's stories, there's pieces of information which justify having a ruler on top. And I'd say even Hobbes, in many ways, is just another story of subjugation.
Yes, indeed. The other characteristic seems to be important is to keep the rulers at a distance from the hoi polloi. In other words, to have them quasi-invisible so that you could have these stories of their dominance and supremacy maintained through sheer lack of awareness and direct obvious. You know, you don't see them going to the loo, for example. You don't see the emperor doing that kind of thing.
Exactly.
One thing that I think also needs to be made clear to listeners is that the Holocene was stimulated by a climatic shift towards a more even-handed, uninterrupted sort of weather pattern that was not characteristic of generations and millennia prior to that time.
Precisely. So the Holocene was not just a more warm climatic period, it was also an exceptionally, at least by historical standards, stable one. And that also meant that once again, you had more stability in order to foster lootable resources and Goliaths. And it's worth noting that I mentioned there were all these different hierarchical hunter-gatherers and cities across the United States, these early Goliaths across North America. And interestingly, they all undergo a kind of synchronized collapse, including Cahokia, during the onset of an ice age, which, well, not quite an ice age, we call it the Little Ice Age, I should say, which is basically a period where regional temperatures were roughly 1 degree cooler, and it made growing corn much more difficult. That had other knock-on effects, but that seems to be one of the factors that led to the collapse of these early Goliaths. And as I mentioned in the book, it's not just that, it's also the fact that they were growing more unequal, power was growing more concentrated, and that seems to, by nature, make Goliaths increasingly fragile.
It's interesting, there's a phrase that struck a chord with me as a physician, because dietary habits changed a lot during the Holocene. And you made the point, and I love the phrase, agriculture was a wrecking ball to human health. The fact that people actually, the overall health, dental caries and all sorts of other changes took place after we got this period of calm in terms of climatic change and the expansion of communities to make them into nascent and then eventual Goliaths. It wasn't actually very good for our health. It kind of made us a little sicker.
No, precisely. When you look at different populations across the world, it's quite clear that they get substantially shorter during the intensification of agriculture, often by a few inches. And human height is a good overall indicator of biophysical health.
Indeed.
People who undergo famines, for instance, who are exposed to disease, who have less calories, less protein, less exercise, tend to be shorter. On top of that, you also see the emergence of the infectious diseases that have plagued our history. For instance, influenza, smallpox. These things really only start to emerge once you get sufficiently big cities and you get a melting pot of animals and humans stuffed together. That's what allows for zoonotic infections to spread from animals into us and essentially creates all the great scourges that we now associate with disease. Most hunter-gatherers wouldn't have had to deal with those same ones. They wouldn't have had influenza or smallpox or yellow fever. on top of all that, is this simply you start to see people getting more dental caries from having worse diets, so basically holes in their teeth because they're eating far too many carbohydrates and not enough of a varied diet in general. And on top of all that, you start to see different kinds of stress fractures. For instance, in the Near East, women start to develop these interesting deformations, often their knees and ankles, from basically rocking back and forth, kneading grain so frequently.
Yeah, form follows function, which is which is not exactly what people were hoping for. I mentioned at the beginning that this book, Goliath's Curse, is deeply driven by documentation. And I speculate a little bit that if you want to shift a paradigm, you have to have evidence that's so incontrovertible that nobody can really chase you down and chastise you for having said something different from the current dogma. You have nearly 100 pages of references, and they are deep, and they cover all sorts of different subject matter. But I also want to comment on the fact that the acknowledgments are also the acknowledgments, the gratitude expressed towards a whole range of people who helped out. And the contrast between that and, say, Homer, the Iliad and the Odyssey, Thucydides, History of the Peloponnesian War, Plato's Discourses, Churchill's History of the English-Speaking People, all of these things were written by one person or part of a cultural tradition recited by one person. They were very much more narrow in terms of the base on which they were, the evidentiary base on which they were situated. Why don't you talk a little bit about why? Well, you said you changed your attitude about many things as you were researching this book, but how important it is today to have lots of data, congruence based on what's in the data, not in your own consciousness, but also having others scrutinize. I can't remember how many people read the entire manuscript, and often more than once, as it was being prepared. So you had a genuine kind of cadre of associates and assistants and friends and neighbors involved in this whole process. Why don't you talk about how important that is?
It is absolutely instrumental and vital. I had somewhere around probably 24 or more people in the book, either chapters or the entirety of the manuscript. And that was simply necessary. I was covering so many different areas, including those which are outside my expertise, that even if I read copiously, I still wouldn't have their ability,
you couldn't read enough,
their knowledge.
No,
basically, you just also can't compete here. Like if I, for instance, want to know about the fall of Rome, I can definitely read a lot of books. So I can talk to a lot of people, but ultimately someone like Walter Schadow, who's a professor of classics at Stanford University who spent his entire career thinking about the fall of Rome and the Han Dynasty, etc. I'll never be able to compete with his level of expertise and nuance.
Yes.
And so hence, in many ways, I had to rely upon these different experts. And I really did in many cases, like with Eric Klein, for instance, when it came to the late Bronze Age collapse, Walter Schadow, as mentioned, people like John Haldon as well. All of them were absolutely pivotal for making sure that the ideas here were as sound as possible. Mm. And on top of that, even just friends and family could help me understand which bits of the book were most easily read and understood by a lay reader and which ones were pretty terrible and need to be sharpened up. Overall, whether it be simply making an eloquent text or making the arguments as bulletproof as possible, you had to rely upon others. This was a team effort in many ways.
One of your most heartfelt expressions of gratitude towards you was towards your brother, David. And I was struck by that because family members, I mean, often people dedicate a book to a family member and you know that they were there cooking meals and, taking out the washing and stuff like that. But what was it special about David, apart from the fact that his name is the same as that of the person who knocked Goliath off in the Christian Bible? What role did he play for you in this whole process?
Yeah, I couldn't miss the poetic eloquence of having
a book dedicated
to David, which is called Goliath's Curse.
Yeah,
but David has been my ultimate cheerleader. I mentioned the book that he was the first one to read the book proposal. He was the first one to read the entire manuscript, and he read every single manuscript draft thereafter as well.
Oh, good Lord.
And apart from that, just throughout my life, he's been an inspiration, a mentor, a best friend, and a father figure as well. And
so he's older than you, obviously.
He is. He's 11 years older. He's my oldest boy. I only have one brother, but yes, he's my oldest brother.
Yeah.
But yeah, I couldn't imagine writing it without him.
Well, that kind of acknowledgement is also something that appears in nonfiction literature, that people admit that who you have in your life, who's a personal connection, do you have a personal connection to, is just as important in many ways as somebody who's, you know, on the top of the tree in some particular subject area. I want to close with just a few comments about human psychology. Often psychology never appears anywhere in sort of didactic, data-driven documentation about phenomena, material phenomena or historical phenomena. But you make mention of it. You talk about, for example, the dark triad of antisocial psychopathy, narcissism, and Machiavellianism. Those are characteristics that are expressed by a fully formed adult person. But it's clear that how people are raised, we can see a few political figures right now who are raised in distorted ways and are acting in distorted ways in their adulthood. And I looked around, because this is a matter of interest to me, because I actually have done psychotherapy for 50 years and I see what's inside people's heads quite a bit. And I came across a paper. Its title is completely uninspiring. It says, "Higher self-assessed subjective social status is associated with worse perceptions of others' emotions." And that's actually the thesis of the paper. And that is, in other words, the more wealthy, the more powerful, the more socially influential you become, the less you concern yourself with what everybody else is going through. And I want to just ask you to maybe close out with a remark about that, about how it's almost an inevitable characteristic. You get big, heavily structured societies with horizontal stratification. You start to get, or vertical stratification, rather, you start to get a loss of sensitivity to one another.
I already mentioned the authoritarian impulse, and that's one of four characteristics which I refer to as the darker angels of our nature. You mentioned another one, the dark triad. And this inability to empathize with others as you get higher status, it's part of what I call power corrupting. We have a wealth of evidence now that when people get to higher positions in a hierarchy, when they become more powerful, they tend to take on a range of other attributes, become more likely to cheat both in games and on their spouses. They become less empathetic and compassionate towards others. They tend to become less risk adverse. And they also even have impediments to their ability to do what's called mirroring, where you essentially mimic the behavior and the body language of other people in order to build a rapport. And all of this points towards a pretty clear idea, and that's that once you get these big dominance hierarchies, they attract people who want status. Mm-hmm. They attract people who are higher in the dark triad because they tend to want status much more than others and are willing to take it by force. Mm. And even the decent people who got into positions of power tend to become corrupted by power. So we've essentially created systems that in many ways select for the worst of us. And in some ways, the basic thesis of the book could be summarized as our institutions are selecting for the worst of us. In the long term, that will lead to them destroying themselves. The life's curse.
You've spoken out of the new discipline called collapsology, and it's sort of like Thomas Hobbes incarnated in a kind of an intellectual construct. But I think your book is ultimately, and you make some, you use the word bullshit, and you were talking about what we can do about the problems we face and how some of the things that we've believed in the past are really just flat out erroneous and irrelevant. But I must say that your book is striking, certainly struck me, and I think it's going to increasingly strike other people as showing a pathway. The pathway is driven by the fact that we humans are not living lives that are nasty, brutish, and short. And if we are, it's because we've made a mistake and we should stop doing that. And our relationship with one another fundamentally are driven by more creative, more amiable connections and interconnections. So I think you've done a great service to all of us. And Luke, it's been a delight to have you on the radio today. And thank you so much for taking the time to be with us.
No worries, Warren. And the pleasure was all mine. Thank you.